Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 166. I'm recording it on Friday, September 18th, 2009. The PE10 level today is 19. That's not too good. The long-term value proposition of stocks is less than exciting at today's prices. The title of the music for this podcast is A Little Boogie. The title of the podcast is The New Luxuries. I'll tell you a little story about how to get in trouble on the internet. I'll tell you a story about how to get in trouble on the internet. I was this came up, this podcast, this is a saving podcast. I mentioned a few back that I want to do a few on saving. I want to mix some in and free my mind of our investing troubles every now and again. And this morning, I check out the Get Rich Slowly blog when I can, and J.D. Roth writes that blog, and he had something up there today about the 10% saving rule, the standard rule for that we're supposed to use to know how much to save. I don't think too much of that rule, and I said why, and I added after I had given my basic explanation, I just added, I think, one sentence, and I just said, this rule of thumb is dated. It is a dated rule of thumb. And it hit me when I was saying that that's a big problem in the personal finance area. It's a huge problem. My guess is, humans are humans, and my guess is it's not just this area. Maybe it's true in all sorts of areas. You know, there's a saying in wars, they say, generals fight the last battle. In other words, they study history to find out what works, and when they find out what works, they get all excited, and then a new battle comes where new weapons have been invented, and then there are a different sort of terrain, and all the circumstances are different. And they go ahead and use strategies that worked in the last battle, and they get slaughtered. And my guess is we're doing this in all areas of human life, but the area I study is personal finance, and boy, do I ever see it there. And of course, there's a good saying, people that post on discussion boards, they often have a little quote, below their name. Not often, but sometimes. And on the Bogleheads board, they have that. And one guy has a quote. I can't quote it exactly, but the gist of it is, new ideas don't prevail by the power of the argument made for them. New ideas prevail when when the people who hold the old ideas get old and die. And, that's what we're up against. Just to flip back briefly to the investing side, a point that I try to make in regard to valuation-informed indexing, I try to make it often because I think it's so important, is valuation-informed indexing benefits every single human being alive. It even benefits non-investors because it provides stability in the markets. And even if you invest not a penny in stocks, you are hurt by passive investing because passive investing causes crashes. And crashes cause economic crises. And so even if you invest not a penny in stocks, you still benefit from valuation-informed indexing because valuation-informed indexing would stabilize the markets. And so I make this point. I'll say every single human being alive benefits from valuation-informed indexing. And I'll say, I'll be on a board and people are throwing bricks at me and all this stuff, and I'll say, can anybody tell me any downside to considering valuations? I've given a list of 20 positives. Can anybody give me a downside? And no one ever can. Sometimes the goons will get sarcastic and they'll put up a post of their own and they'll say, can anybody see a downside? And they're clearly making fun of me, but they never answer the question. Well, the point of that is, what's going on. You know, I rack my brain trying to understand why anyone would oppose valuation-informed indexing with all the wonderful things it does for us. Allows us to retire 5 years sooner and, you know, less risk in investing and higher return and more stability and less emotional angst and all these things. And I, you know, maybe sometimes, you know, there's a saying that the simplest explanation is the best. What's this thing? Occam's razor or something? Just go with the obvious. You know, sometimes you don't have to think it through so much. Maybe the answer is just people think passive investing it works because people have been saying it for so long. It's just like it's inertia. Inertia is one of the greatest powers on the face of planet Earth. Did the devil invent inertia? Man, oh man. So, the same thing is true in saving. And that struck me this morning. And that's why I said, I think I'll do a podcast on the new luxuries today. You know, this idea that you should save 10% of your income, I think it is it's clearly not ill-intended, but I don't think there's much to it. These things don't get developed without there being some truth. In other words, somebody did some sort of calculation, and if we spent some time on it, we could figure out what it was, and they came up with this 10% thing. But this was years ago. God knows how long that's been around. 1950? And the world is just a different place 60 years later. And so people are following the same rule. And you know, 60% of the conditions that gave rise to the rule no longer apply. So the rule doesn't make any sense. But the problem is, you know, books have been written and seminars have been developed. And the people don't want to change the seminars and the books and the speeches. And so we just keep going on. It's easier to give the advice that, you know, worked in 1950 than it is to redo it. So we just keep doing it that way. But the purpose should be to help people save effectively. And it doesn't do it. And has there ever been a stronger case that something doesn't work than our saving advice? We're a rich nation. And our saving numbers are just, you can't even believe them. They're a negative number half the time. And doesn't that give you a, you know, things should be measured. We live in a society in which we measure, you know, a manager or a general manager traded for an outfielder and they brought him in to hit a lot of home runs and they put him in the fourth slot, the cleanup slot. And in July, he's only got 3 home runs. Somebody would stop, right? And they'd say, you know, good idea to hire, you know, bring this guy in, trade for this guy. But fact of the matter is, he's not hitting any home runs. And either we should get rid of him or you know, bat him somewhere else in the lineup. But he's not a cleanup hitter. In other words, if it doesn't work, there's a saying, if it's not broke, don't fix it. Well, if it is broke, do fix it. And our saving ideas are broke, friends and neighbors. They don't work. Feels good to get excited about a saving topic instead of an investing topic, like the old days. Our saving ideas do not work. Do not work. So this 10% rule, I'm going to go into the 10% rule because that's not really the topic here. But the point is, what got me riffing here is the dated phrase. I said, well, this is dated. In other words, this 10% rule, people don't follow it because it makes sense. People don't follow it because they tested it and they found this helps people to save. People don't follow it for any logical, sensible reason. They just follow it because if you're writing an article and you stick in, oh, everybody should save 10%, no one's going to argue with you because they're all going to be intimidated by the fact they've heard that same rule 10,000 times before. Doesn't matter that it doesn't work. And they're not going to give you any grief. But if you say no, actually, that's dumb. Actually, there are some times when you should be saving 0% and there are other times when you should be saving 50%. If you say that, And then you give a logical case for why it's so. They'll say,
oh, this guy, he doesn't know what he's talking about because all these experts say it should be 10%.
Are they experts? Or are they just people who read a book and copied it? State it. I do think it made some sense. You know, I don't think these people that came up with the 10% rule were out to get us. I'm sure it made some sense. And if I spent a little time on it, I think I discuss it in my book, actually, Passion Saving. If I spent a little time on it, you know, I could tell you why. You know, I don't think I want to go into it, but maybe a different podcast. But it's dated. Made sense. Once upon a time, we live in a different world 60 years later, and we need different rules. So, when I was saying how to get in trouble, okay, I wanted to get back to that, how to get in trouble, and then I'll delve into the meat of the podcast. But I was thinking about all these things, you know, a trait that I have is the connections, and think different. I see connections between different things, and so I wrote that phrase, date it, and that just hit me, and I said, yeah, I've got to do a podcast about that, because it excited me, because of that's true in the investing area, you know, that this passive investing is an idea that made some sense once upon a time, but that is dated. It's been disproven, it's been discredited, and people won't drop it. There's this organizational, I don't know what, resistance to change. And so that got me excited. And that's true in the saving area. I've never had bricks thrown at me in the saving area like I have in the investing area, but I do think that the same thing applies. So anyway, my personal history is that one day, I don't know how long ago, it was a long time ago now, try to think how long ago. Oh, this must have been in, I was writing at Motley Fool in 99 and 2000. And in 2001, I took a hiatus. So this had to be in 2001, early 2001, maybe March 2001. And I started writing my book, Passion Saving. And I said, you know what? You're going to have to make a choice here. If you follow this idea, your book is going to change. The whole book is going to be an argument on why the conventional saving approach doesn't work. That's where you're headed with these ideas. Do you want to go there, friend? Because there's going to be people mad at you. If only I knew. They didn't get mad at me on the saving, at least not so far. But when this is the story I'm telling. I said, yeah, I'm going to go there. I decided to go there, you know. And the whole book became radically changed and a very exciting book, if I have to say so myself. It all became a book on, you know, rejecting the conventional model and essentially setting up a whole new model of money management. And I think what happened, one of the things that happened is that gave me confidence. You know, I had some confidence in my writing because I've been a journalist all my life, but, you know, I'd been writing for newsletters and, you know, I went to law school, so I had written legalistic kind of things. You know, I'd been working in a big six accounting firm, so, you know, I had done writing there, but it was more technical. And this was writing for a general audience, writing for the average person. And, you know, I wasn't so sure of myself. And when I wrote these ideas, which were new and exciting and work, I mean, I think I have a tough enough judge of my own stuff that I can say that the arguments stand up. I mean, you can refute them. I don't object. But they're arguments that should be considered. They're not silly. They hold up. Well, I gained some confidence. I was a much more confident writer in the personal finance field after writing that book than I was before. Now, after I wrote the book, that's when I came back to the Motley Fool board and I saw, you know, the troubles we were having with stocks were going down and these abusive posters were attacking all the best community members. And that's when I made this decision. I was going to have to tell the truth about safe withdrawal rates, whether I liked the idea or not, whether I was afraid to do so or not. I was going to have to work up the courage. But I doubt that I could have worked up the courage before because I knew people were going to throw bricks at me. I had no idea how many, but I knew there were going to be some bricks. And I felt confident that I could handle that after writing that book. And if I hadn't written it, I don't think I would have. And a big part of it was that the book was such a departure from the conventional thinking. So, you know, the way to get in trouble on the internet is to write something, you know, different against conventional wisdom that is strong enough to stand up to scrutiny, and people will get very defensive and very upset. And you know, we live that every day. You know, most of the podcast here, what is this, number 166? Well, about, you know, 163 of them are investing podcasts. So 164, I think, are investing podcasts. So, you know, you can hear a lot about that side of the story, but this is on the saving side. Now, on the saving side, I haven't had as many bricks thrown at me, but the saving ideas explored at PassionSaving.com are really every bit as quote-unquote controversial as the investing ideas, because they are a rejection of the conventional model. Just as rational investing is a rejection of the passive investing model, passion saving is a rejection of sacrifice saving. Sacrifice saving is my name for the conventional saving approach. And the new luxuries, I when I wrote the book, there are parts to it, and three parts. And the title for part two is The New Luxuries. And I wrote the title originally came to me when I was at Motley Fool, and I wrote a post, which I titled The New Luxuries. It was very well received. And I've always felt that I remember that entire post came to my head when the title. I was in the shower, and the title, The New Luxuries, came to me. And, you know, I got dried off and dressed and went downstairs, and I just wrote the whole thing. Because once I came up with the title, the whole thing just fell into place. The New Luxuries says something, those three words. They say something. And they say something with implications that reach in many directions. It changes the money management model. Because saving, for my entire lifetime, has been promoted as a negative. Saving has been promoted as something hard. Saving has been promoted as something requiring self-denial. Saving has been promoted as something boring and responsible. And the argument that I make is that saving gives us access to luxuries that spending can never give us access to. So the reason that you should save is not because you want to be responsible, or not because you're afraid that if you don't do it, you're going to be punished, you're going to suffer. The reason you should save is because you want to go for the gusto. You want to leave the imprint of your personality on this world. You want to have fun. And there's a fun that you can have from saving that you cannot have through spending. And that fun is the new luxuries. So let's talk a little bit about what saving can do for you, how saving can change your life in a very positive way. I remember when I came out with the report, Secrets of Retiring Early, I had a friend back in Washington. He had worked with me at Daily Tax Report, Mitch. Mitch was a good friend of mine. We used to meet for lunch, and then, I don't know, we used to do it once or twice a week, and then when I was at Daily Tax Report, and then when I went to, I put out the report, I was at the accounting firm, but Mitch and I sort of stayed in touch. We, you know, we didn't get together as often, but I don't know, every couple of months we would get together, and so when I came out with the report, I was very excited about it, and I brought a copy to him. And I remember, I don't know if he sent me an email, but he basically told me his reaction. And his reaction was, and I, you know, I listened for the things that are said and the things that are not said. And he, you know, he gave the normal standard, the, oh, well written and all that sort of thing. But the thing he said that struck me was, he said, I liked it that you don't, I don't remember what words he used, but the gist of it was, I liked it that you were non-judgmental about the people who don't save. So I really felt he was hitting on something, because people, you know, the idea that you're supposed to save is omnipresent. It's omnipresent. And totally ignored. I mean, it's just totally ignored by just about everybody. And what, you know, the reason is because it all comes across as a sermon. You know, it's. I mean, frankly, I think that's part of the problem I have in the investing area. A part of the problem I have with that message is the message that, you know, we should be honest, that we should report the retirement numbers accurately. It comes across as a bit of a sermon, because what I'm preaching is honesty, you know. And it's sort of like, oh, yeah, we don't want to be honest. You know, we want to pretend we have three times what we have. Bull markets are fun, man, you know. And see, I just don't believe that. I believe that I don't want to be preachy, but I want honesty, because I actually think honesty helps us. Honesty enhances our enjoyment of life, and I think making up phony numbers, which is what passive investors do, telling yourself fairy tales, hurts you, causes you great pain, and I'm trying to relieve the pain. I'm trying to alleviate the pain. And, but you know, I try to do it in a non-preachy way. You know, in other words, I try to focus on the gains that you can retire 5 years sooner if you'll pay attention to valuations, you know, which is honest investing. But people who have spent years doing it the other way, they don't really deny that, but they're defensive about it. They're defensive about the destruction they've done to themselves. But I definitely am aware that you have to avoid being preachy in your writing. And in the personal finance field, it's a bit of a temptation, probably in all fields. But in the personal finance field, it's definitely a temptation. You know, I know the answers, and you're dumb, you know, because you don't. That's, you know, that's implicit in so much writing in this field. And it's such a turnoff, such a turnoff. So I try to avoid that, but as I say, on the investing side, it's a little hard because there's so much baggage. People get so wrapped up emotionally in the fairy tales. And but on the saving side, what I liked was that at least one person, he's not the only person who said this sort of thing, noticed that my approach was avoiding that. And I think it's so important. There was a guy at the Wall Street Journal, he quoted me in an article, and there's a link to it there. If you go to the homepage of the blog, A Rich Life, go down the left-hand side, and there's a section there called People Are Talking, and I have quotes, things that people have said about the site or about the book or whatever. And there's one there from a guy at the Wall Street Journal, and it has the link to where he said it, which is an article. And he only quoted me for a sentence or two, but he said, you know, Rob Bennett believes it's packaging. A big problem. The reason why people don't save, it's a packaging problem. And boy, do I ever believe that. You know, his article was advocating making a default where people giving to their 401k, instead of having to opt in, you would just be opted in unless you opted out. And the idea was that more people would save. And of course, it's true. More people will save if they have to opt out. That's certainly true. But one thing I'm not crazy about with that idea is that there's a suggestion there that to save, you have to be forced to do it. You have to be forced. And so implicit there is the idea that it's a negative. Saving is like eating your vegetables. And I hate that. That, you know, in my mind, the whole problem in investing is the idea that you don't have to look at price. That's all of our problems traced back to that root. All of them. And in saving, all of our problems are traced back to the root that saving is boring. And if people think it's boring, they're not going to do it. And no matter how much you try to cajole them, they are going to resist. And people are mules. And yeah, you might find ways to trick them into saving a little bit here and there. But ultimately, if they don't want to do it, they're going to figure out a way not to do it. They really are. And on the other hand, if you get them on your side, if you get them to believe, you know, it's their idea to save, they will overcome any barrier. Any barrier. I have this with my kids, with belief in God. You know, I believe in God. I didn't go to church for many years, but I do today, and I want my kids to believe in God. And so, you know, one of the things we do is we read them catechism or whatever, 5 minutes, whatever, I don't know. And, you know, you sort of hope that some of this is going to stick, but I never feel comfortable with that. I never feel comfortable that that's going to do it. But something I do I do as a parent, I think this is probably the thing I'm best at, is I will bring God into the conversation, you know, all kinds of subjects. Not at all in a preachy way. And I don't think of God that way. You know, I think of God in a sort of personal way, but my hope is that that will stick with them. You know, but because I just believe, yeah, you know, you can say, oh, you know, you have to do this, you have to go to church or whatever it is you have to do. And if it's an idea you're imposing on them, it is not going to stick, you know, not in today's world, not, you know, even in the old days, it didn't really stick. But today, there's so many things not to go that way that it's not going to stick. And, you know. But if it's in your heart, if it's in your heart, you might stop going, you know, for a long time. But if it's in your heart, you're going to find your way back. And to some extent, I feel that's what happened with me. I mean, I didn't go to church for 20, 25 years, but I think something was in my heart. Something was. And I came back. So my point is, we need to stop this, you know, most of the advice is surface. And what we need to do is change the heart. And you change the heart by making people embrace saving. And so, the idea of the new luxuries is a concept. And the question is, well, let's get down to the root. Why should people save? And don't say to provide for their retirement. That's not the answer. That's the boring answer. That's the answer that doesn't work. And a big part of my book is explaining why it doesn't work. It doesn't work because, not because people are stupid. You see, this is the point Mitch was making. The standard answer for why it doesn't work is, well, people don't have willpower. That's such an insult. It's insulting your reader, insulting your listener. People don't have willpower. That's why they don't save. So in other words, we're all losers. So you start out by telling people they're losers, and then you say, okay, now listen to listen to my advice. And what happens is 9 out of 10 of the people in the audience tune you out as soon as you tell them they're losers. And they'll shake their head. I'll say, oh, yeah, good advice. Oh, yes, we should save 10%. Oh, yes. But they don't do it. It's not in their heart. And they're not losers. The loser is the guy standing on the stage telling them to do it. Because he's getting paid the big bucks to help them save, and they're not saving. So who's a loser? Maybe he's financially a winner. But in terms of doing something useful, he's a loser. Why do we save? What? Why should we save? Or shouldn't we? Maybe we shouldn't. You know, start with that. Maybe we shouldn't. What would we lose if we didn't save? You know, say there were an alternate universe where saving was forbidden. Saving was prohibited. It's against the law. You can't save. Would we regret it? Would we say, yippee? Or would we be sad because something had been taken from us? What saving allows you to do is, saving empowers you. If we were forbidden from saving, something very, very important would have been taken from us. What saving is, we all get paid a certain amount of money. It's a different amount for each person, but we all have certain number of dollars passed through our hands during the course of our lifetime. And being able to spend is nice. I'm totally opposed to this idea that spending is bad. Being able to spend is good. Spending gives us access to goods and services. And goods are fun. Monkey albums. And services are fun. You know, African safaris, you know, tour guides. So spending is good. But what you want when you have money is you want to have as many options as you possibly can have. The more options, the better. Because there might be a time when monkey albums just, you know, light your fire. And there was a time when that was true for me. First thing I saved for in my life was More of the Monkees. Second album. But, you know, if the Monkees came out with a new album today, I probably wouldn't even know about it. So it doesn't matter to me today. So something that excites you at one time of life may not excite you at another time. So you want to have options. More of the Monkees was a great value proposition for me when I was whatever age I was, when I bought it. It's a great value proposition. I listened to it every day for an entire summer, sometimes twice a day. It was a horrible value proposition for my parents and my neighbors, but it was great for me. But you want options. What saving is an extra option. It says yes, you know, and of course there's more than one option. There's more than one good you can spend on. It's not just monkey albums. There's thousands and thousands of things. Thousands of goods, thousands of services. But saving opens up new possibilities. And this was really the whole idea. When I saved for that album, that More of the Monkees album, I was getting an allowance. I think it was about $1 a week. And I used to buy Mallow cups. I think they were like, I don't know, a quarter maybe? You know, on the way back from lunch, going to school. I'd buy Mallow cups. And I wanted this album. It was $4 at the Grants department store. And so it was the first, you know, the idea came into my head. I mean, I could whine about it. In those days, your parents, you know, today you can whine and your parents will get it for you. But in those days, forget it. It wasn't going to work. I mean, I could whine about it. They weren't interested in my problems. They weren't going to buy me More of the Monkees. My father, I probably told this story before. I still carry this cross, but it makes me laugh. But I had wanted I think it was after the Monkees. I wanted Meet the Beatles. I loved the Monkees. I fell in love with the Monkees. And then I wanted to graduate to the Beatles. And I asked my dad, you know, and for some reason he did take some pity on me, but he went, you know, he would always look for bargains, and he went to, I don't know, Kresge's or something. I don't know, some department store. And it makes me laugh. And, instead of getting, you know, Meet the Beatles, who knows what they were charging for Meet the Beatles, at least $4, maybe $5, $6. And he said, well, that's, you know, that's too much. I'm not going to get a Meet the Beatles. So he saw an album called The Munsters. And there was a television show, The Munsters, and this was a singing group. And they would sing songs. They were rock and roll songs about, you know, monsters and stuff. And he bought that. It was like $1, you know. And I was like, well, Dad, this isn't the Beatles, you know. And to him, it was all the same thing. You know, it was like Munsters, Beatles, you know, same basic concept. But the funny part of it was the Munsters album was actually pretty darn good. And I still remember those songs. I didn't have any other albums, you know, other than More of the Monkees. So I played it a lot, and it wasn't really bad, actually. It wasn't quite the Beatles, but it wasn't bad. All right. So anyway, so the point here was, okay, I could have the Mellow Cups. And I was happy with that. But I had this feeling that I'd rather have More of the Monkees. Well, the truth is, as long as saving was prohibited against the law, I was never going to have More of the Monkees. I mean, you know, unless my life changed, I could live 100 years. I was never going to have it. Why? Because my allowance was a dollar. And if I was required to spend a dollar every week, I never could buy anything that costs more than a dollar. It was out of the question. So I could buy Mellow Cups if I wanted to. I could graduate up to, you know, jumbo size Hershey bars, but I couldn't go above a dollar unless I could save. If I could save, you know, a whole new horizons opened up. And it hit me one day. I said, I'm not going to ask dear old dad to get me More of the Monkees because he'll come back with, you know, the Addams Family. I mean, you know, who knows what he's going to do. I got to save. It hit me. I could save. If I just stopped buying Mallow Cups for 4 weeks, I'd have $4 and I could get More of the Monkees. Could make it happen. Make it a reality. So the point here is, if there had been, saving didn't hurt me. Saving wasn't boring. Saving wasn't responsible. Saving was liberating. It gave me an option. I wanted More of the Monkees and now I had it. Because I was allowed to save. And so that's how we have to think about saving if we want to become successful savers. Stop thinking about it as, you know, imposing this responsibility upon yourself, imposing this self-denial, and think about it in terms of what can I get that I can't get without it? And, you know, of course, the way they always portray it is, well, you should save in order to be able to retire. Well, again, they take a positive and turn it into a negative. They make it as negative as you could possibly make it. Why? Because most of us don't want to be 65. And we're not going to get the fruits of this saving until we are. And so the picture in our mind of what saving can get us is a negative. But take the concept. Just think about what retirement is. What retirement is having money coming into your life that you don't have to work for. In other words, put a certain amount of capital aside, and that money will generate earnings, and money comes in every day, and you don't have to get out of bed if you don't feel like it. Well, that's not something you can do only at 65. You could do that at 55 or 45 or 35. You can do it anytime you want. In other words, you could save, instead of saving for a old age retirement, you could save for a sabbatical. You could say, I'm going to put aside a certain amount of money, and I'm going to take a year off. And if you want to, you could do it. I'm not saying it's a good idea, bad idea. That's for you to say. But saving doesn't care. Saving will clearly allow you to do it. You clearly don't have to save as much to take a one-year sabbatical as you would to retire for, you know, 30 years. It can be done. Put some money aside. Have it generate an income by investing it properly. And you don't have to work. Or, you know, you can carve it up lots of different ways. You could take a job that pays less. You know, because you've now got a certain amount of money put aside generating an income, and so you can take a job that pays less that you like more. And still live at the same, you know, the same level you did before. In other words, you'd have some money coming in from your job and other money coming in from your accumulated earnings stash, your financial independence stash. That's what saving buys you. So, saving has nothing to do with old age. That's just something they plugged in. You know, I've gotten a little bit cynical over the years. I don't like to be a cynical person, but You know, what I'll often say now on the passive investing front, you know, I've had so many bricks thrown at me that I now, you know, you can't help but wonder, you know, what is the motive here? And I don't think the motive is I don't want to be overly cynical. I don't want to paint it all bad. But you do wonder if, you know, a big part of it is just that the people who are called experts in the investing field, they push passive investing because passive investing is not paying attention to price, just buying stocks no matter what the price. And that's, you know, that's real nice if you're in the stock selling industry. Who wouldn't want somebody to buy their product without regard to price? So you can't help but wonder, okay? I do think that's a factor. I do think that's a factor. I don't see how it couldn't be. Well, in the saving realm, I guess I wonder a little bit. And I haven't had as many bricks thrown at me, so I'm not quite as cynical in this realm. But a little bit, you wonder if the reason they push old age is because they don't want us to save too much. I don't want to take this too far because, you know, you get into the point where you're involved in conspiracy theories, and I don't think that's fruitful. But again, you can't help but wonder a little bit because we do live in a world, we live in a consumer wonderland where there's a lot of wonderful things to buy. But there is an incentive on the people giving the advice. You know, like a lot of saving advice comes from people in banks and stuff like that. And you, I don't know. Do they want us to save or not? You know, or magazines. Just take you know, Money Magazine. I mean, I like Money Magazine, but they sell a lot of products. You know, they have cover stories saying how to save, but then you look inside and they got all these glossy pictures of cars, and there's nothing wrong with cars. But as I'm saying, you know, do they really want us to save? I guess I wonder sometimes if they really gave effective saving advice, maybe people wouldn't buy as many cars. And the advertisers wouldn't like it. Maybe that's part of what's going on. That's part of the reason why our saving, you know, our saving percentage is so bad. I think there's something to that. Maybe I'll have to do a separate podcast on that as well. But the point here is, you don't have to think about old age when you save. That's just, that's an idea that's been grafted on to the saving concept, and I think it does a lot of harm. It turns saving into a fearful endeavor. I don't want to be eating cat food when I'm 80, so I'm going to save. Well, fine. But how much do you think that's going to inspire you to save? It's going to inspire you to save tiny little bits. It does, you know, cause there is some fear-induced saving that goes on, but not a lot. But if you started thinking about it as the way to get access to monkey albums, now you're not going to be saving 5% and 10%. You're going to be saving 40% and 50%. My wife and I, we were in special circumstances, but still, before, you know, we sort of followed a weird story, but we didn't have children until we'd been married a number of years, unfortunately. I wish we had more, but, you know, there was a time when we were married and we were both employed, you know, and what do they call them? Dinks, you know, double income, no kids. And we paid off our mortgage, the first thing we did. And then, you know, with no mortgage and no kids, and we were living frugally because I wanted to save money so I could do this writing stuff. We were saving 80% of post-tax income. Our taxes were huge. But, you know, after-tax income, we were saving almost everything. We were living on very little money. You know, she was cooking the meals at home. We weren't going out to eat. You know, we were economizing everywhere. And, we had a car, but I usually took the bus to work. So we just, just one car. It was a small car. You know, we were really economizing. And we were saving a huge amount of money. I mean, one year we saved, I think the highest year was $88,000. I don't say that to brag. That's not the point. It's just to say I never would have saved $88,000, you know, because somebody scared me that I was going to be eating cat food. I saved $88,000 because it could change my life. I wanted to be able to write about things that I wanted to write about, rather than have a boss tell me, and the only way I was going to get there was by saving $88,000. That's what it took. So that's what I did. But I didn't do it out of sacrifice. I didn't do it out of self-denial. I did it because it excited me. And you can do the same. Stop thinking about saving as your ticket to old age, not eating cat food, and you'll save a whole lot more than you're saving today. I had people, I know, when I wrote my report, the first comment I got, you know, it sticks in your head, Secrets of Retiring Early, and this guy, and he wanted to argue with me. You know, I was saying saving, and most people loved the report. But this one guy got, I mean, not abusive, but he got hostile. And he was saying, I can't save anything, you know, more than I am. And I said, well, I don't know. I said, have you looked at your budget? But see, the problem is I could spend my whole life talking to that guy. And if he's hostile, his mind is closed. But if you flipped it and there was something he could get out of it, that would have changed it. See, it's the motivation. You know, motivation is everything. If you want to save, you will find a way. You will overcome the barriers. You will break free. But if you don't want to save, you'll make a million excuses. And as long as saving is portrayed as something negative, something boring, people are not going to be motivated. So the idea here is that saving has a positive. Spending gives goods and services. Saving gives freedom and opportunity. Freedom because when you save, what you're doing, the goal, is to set aside a financial independence stash which generates income, which means every dollar generated by your saving is a dollar you don't have to earn by working. You know, I like to make it as simple as I can. I'll just say, say that you save $100. What's that $100 get you? Well, if you can invest it and you believe you can get a 5% real return, what the $100 gets you is $5 of financial freedom. You put $100 into whatever, you know, an index fund, and you follow valuation-informed indexing. You don't want to lose it like all those passive investors do. And you get your $5 or $6 a year on average. Let's say $6. Well, now you can earn, you know, if last year you lived on $50,000, this year you can live on $4,994 because you got $6 coming in from your savings. So you've just relieved yourself of the requirement to earn $6 by getting up when the alarm clock rings and getting on the bus and getting into work and listening to what the boss tells you to do. Now, maybe $6 doesn't sound like that much, but that came from just $100. What if 1,000 is going to multiply it by 10? 10,000 is going to multiply it by 100. 100,000 is going to multiply it by lot. You know? You got to start. You got to start with 100. But you got to do it for the right reasons. You got to have this feeling of being liberated, because when you have that feeling of being liberated, you will knock down walls to figure out ways to save more. And I'm just telling you, I used to, you know, I wanted to be freed from that job, and I made up a budget and I'd carry it in my wallet, and I would pull it out when I was waiting for the bus, and I'd go over it line by line, and I'd say, you know, $23 on this and $37 on this, and can I cut somewhere? I mean, I was a madman, but I enjoyed it. It wasn't like somebody had a gun to my head saying, do this. I was saying, if I can come up with something, I would count how many days. If I can cut this budget category by X amount, how many days sooner can I hand in my resignation to this job? That's a motivated saver. And that's what I want to make you. I want to make you a motivated saver. You've got to care. If you're doing it because you're scared of what's going to happen to you in old age, I can tell you what you're going to do right now. What you're going to do is you're going to dismiss it from your mind. You're going to say, yeah, I should. You're going to shake your head with the preacher in the front of the room. And you're going to say, yeah, he's right. I should save. And then you're going to do whatever you have to do to get your mind off of it. as soon as you get scared, you're going to say, hey, is there a movie on? Because you don't want to think about it. Most of us humans don't like to think about downer stuff. And scary stuff is downer stuff. You know, we don't think about getting cancer. Whether we should or not, we don't. It's a fact. The truth is, if you want to get people to do things, you know, to prevent getting cancer, or prevent getting heart disease or whatever, I don't think scaring them is the way to go. I mean, there might be some cases where there's no other way. And it does sometimes work. Like if somebody has a heart attack, then they'll eat differently. But even then, it only lasts for a year. It wears off. Fear is just not a good motivator, you know. The standard idea is bosses can inspire with fear or with love. And I'm telling you, Rob Bennett's way is love, not fear. And I think the money industry is fear-based. And it's pissing me off. It's true in the saving area and it's true in the investing area. It doesn't work. It's surface. It's cheesy. It's degrading. It's insulting. Drop the fear nonsense. Think about how can saving change my life? And do that. So, this is the concept. The concept is that our model for saving, our model for understanding how money management works, is a fear-based model, and it's a dated model. See, I don't want to go into why it's dated because it'll take up more time, but the short version is it came about at a time when we all had a lot less money running through our hands. Here's a killer. I am going to fit this in because this is important. Do people save more when they have a small amount of money or when they have a large amount of money? Intuitively, you'd say, well, when they have more money, because if they have small money, they can't save. They don't have any. They don't have enough money to save. But if they have large amount of money, they can save a lot. Yeah, well, that makes sense, doesn't it? But it's often not true. One of the big problems we have with saving in our society today is we make too much money. Now, that seems very strange. But you have to think it through. One reason why people wouldn't save that make a lot of money is they don't really feel they need to. They feel, well, I can do it later. I have a lot of money coming in. I can do it later. That's one reason. Another reason is when we have a lot of money, we get used to spending a lot of money. We get in a habit. So much of life is habit. And when you start to spend, everybody's had this experience where when they were in college, they got by on very little money. And then their first job, they get by on a little bit of money. And then they get raises. And a few years down the road, they're getting three times what they used to get paid. And they're still not saving. Why? Because when their income increases a little bit, they increase their spending. And each time they increase it, it becomes a habit. And sometimes the increase causes a bigger increase down the road. In other words, you buy something and you think it's a one-time thing, and you buy a car, you know, and you think, well, it's a lot of money, but I need a car, and it won't be the end of the world. But all of a sudden, now you've got a car. Now you think, well, I can go to baseball games, and I can go to concerts, and I can go to clubs, and I can go on trips, and then you're spending on all those things. Now, again, I don't think any of these things are bad. But the point is, having more money doesn't make it easier to save. It often makes it harder to save, not easier. Because if you didn't have the money to buy the car, you wouldn't even be thinking about the trips and the stadiums and the clubs. The more positive experiences you have with spending, the more you're going to want to spend. What you need, it's not somebody to give you a sermon about how bad you are and how much you lack willpower. What you need are positive saving experiences. And to get some positive saving experiences, you can't wait until you're 65 to take advantage of saving. If you wait until you're 65, you're not going to have any desire to save until you're 65 and you've had a positive experience. You've got to start saving for more fun things, and I don't just mean Monkey albums. Monkey albums is one. For at the age when I bought the Monkey album, that really was a liberating thing because I hadn't, you know, I didn't have access to record albums. So it was a liberating thing. But as a grown-up, you know, a different sort of thing becomes a liberating thing. But it certainly could be liberating to have a you know, a sabbatical. And it certainly could be liberating to pay off your mortgage. That's a great feeling. Talk to people who have done it. It's certainly liberating to have enough money put aside that you're not afraid anymore to talk up in staff meetings, because if you lose your job, you can go a long time on your savings. That's a liberating feeling. It's a liberating feeling to know that you can take a job at less pay. The man doesn't have the finger on you anymore, because you could take a job paying half of the job you have today. What I'm saying is set up a plan to achieve a saving goal that can be achieved in 5 years, not when you're 65. And it has to be something you care about intensely. And if you do, saving will never be the same for you again. You will become one of the most effective savers in the world. This is the secret. This is what truly effective savers do. They don't all verbalize it this way, but if you talk to an effective saver, they get a kick out of saving. That's the point. Now, some of them are just, you know, misers. But misers get a kick out of saving. You know, they just like looking at the numbers. They like the numbers increasing. Well, if you're a miser and you get a kick out of the numbers, fine, that'll work for you. But we all have different personalities. Some of us don't get a kick out of the numbers. So you're going to have to find something that you get a kick out of. But the point is, the reason the miser save is they get constant positive reinforcement from it. They get constant positive reinforcement from it. Now, the point of the new luxuries is that these things you're going to buy, freedom and opportunity, freedom because you don't have to work, or you can work less, and opportunity because, you know, when you can take jobs that pay less, you can ultimately turn those things into moneymakers. In other words, your choices have expanded. But the modern world, you see, these ideas are dated. And the idea that saving was you know, all the fun was in spending, that came about at a time of relative deprivation. We were not as rich a society. And so when people heard the word luxury, they thought, wow, it would be a luxury to have a car. Or wow, you know, it would be a luxury to have a suit. Or wow, it would be a luxury to be able to spend a week at the beach. These were luxuries. You know, I looked at this book. I used to study these things in earlier days. And there was a book called U.S. Standards of Living. And it was just a bunch of charts. It had narrative, too. But a history of what Americans have spent money on. And, you know, you'd look at the... And it was done by the government. Government surveys. You know, they were fairly official things. And they would say, you know, what do people spend... The amount spent on entertainment was a tiny fraction of what it is today. And you'd look at the categories. You know, what was entertainment spending? I don't know what. I can't give you the year. But entertainment, it was like smoking. That was considered entertainment. Smoking and reading the newspaper. Those were entertainment. You know, they didn't have cable. You know, it wasn't there. But now we have it. But the point here is, those were the luxuries, you know, to say, I'm going to go on a vacation. That was a luxury. Today, these things are not really luxuries. A lot of them are not luxuries because the difference, it was a shocking difference to have no vacation at all and then to move up, you know, to having a vacation. That was a big, big, big difference. It was a luxury. Indoor plumbing was a huge luxury. You know, having a refrigerator was a huge luxury compared to the alternative. But a lot of the things we're spending money on today as luxuries, they don't have that much bang for the buck anymore because it's sort of been played out. Now, there still is great stuff out there, but it's like, you know, if you have two computers and you buy a third one, there's some advantage there. There's some excitement, but It's not that big. And so a lot of the spending luxuries have been diluted. But the saving luxuries are huge, because not because saving is better than spending, but because most of us are not taking advantage of the saving luxuries. So what you have is people who run around under pressure, under stress, and complain about their jobs, and have every luxury in the world. They buy luxuries to medicate their pain. I did this. When they could be spending that money, they could be directing that money to saving, spending it at the Freedom Store, I call it, and thereby enjoying the new luxuries. Free time. The subtitle of the book is The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm trying to sell saving. The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. You're giving up your third computer. And maybe you're giving up your cable. And maybe you're cutting back to, you know, a movie every 2 weeks instead of three movies a week. Or, you know, whatever it is. Eating out once a month instead of eating out three times a week. But you're not doing it out of a sense of self-denial. You're doing it because you want to be able to start that business that you've always had in the back of your head. Or you want to be free of worrying about recessions and losing your job and all this sort of thing. Or you want that mortgage paid off. Or whatever it happens to be. Or you want to retire early. Not retire at 65. You want to retire at 50. Or if you're starting young enough, 40. These are luxuries. To retire at 40 or to retire at 50 is a luxury today. It'll knock your, you know, it'll knock your friend's socks off when you tell them at age 50, yeah, I'm hanging it up. Not to, you know, not to go off and sit in a rocking chair, but to do something else with your life. If you can retire at age 50, you know, you got maybe 30 good years before health issues, you know, start to intervene, where you can do some amazing things. You know, it depends on what you want to do. Play instruments or write books or, you know, help the sick or you know, whatever it is. I mean, I can't tell you what it is you want to do. Run marathons. I don't know what it is you want to do. These are what I call the new luxuries. These are luxuries of today, because today we are not deprived of material goods. We got material goods coming at our ears. What we are deprived of is free time. Time just to think, and time to be quiet, and time to spend with friends, time to spend with our children and our spouses. Time to, you know, read. Time to reflect. Time for spiritual growth. That's a luxury. And you can buy it. But you don't buy it. You buy it at a place called the Freedom Store. You buy it by buying your time back. You buy your time back by creating a stash of money that generates money of its own, so you don't have to go to work to generate that sum. That's the idea. There, when I wrote this post, The New Luxuries, and this was a long time ago. This was, I think it was sometime in 2000. I think it might have been March, but I'm not sure. My favorite comment, there were a lot of good comments. There was a thread at Motley Fool, The New Luxuries, and it's a wonderful thread. But these were all my friends. The greatest community I've ever been in on the internet, the Motley Fool community, retire early, back in the golden days. But there was a woman, you know, we were talking about what are the new luxuries, and people would give their idea, you know, of a new luxury. And this one woman said, a luxury today is a marriage, you know, that lasts. And that just broke my heart. I mean, you know, we've all had some rain in our life, and, you know, I've had some. I don't think I've had more than my share. I've had less than my share, but I've had some. But I thank God I've never had a failed marriage. I mean, you know, it would hurt. It would hurt. And I can't say that the reason why we have failed marriage is because of consumerism. You know, the issue is much more complicated than that. But I do think it's a contributing factor. And I don't even think consumerism is a bad thing. I think consumer goods liberate us too in a lot of ways. Computers liberate us, and air conditioning in cars, I think, liberates us. Vacations liberate us. We learn about the world. Eating out liberates us. We get to talk, you know, instead of having to do the dishes and stuff. But if that's all you think you can do with your life is consume, then you end up on a treadmill where it's always about producing more money, and you become sort of a cog in a machine, and no matter how much money you produce, it's never enough. And instead of gaining freedom, you're losing it. And I do think that that contributes to some failed marriages, because the stress, you know, one of the things you need to make a marriage work is to spend time with your spouse sometimes. And if you're always making money and you're always stressed, you're not doing that. And you know, what a price to pay. So this woman, I don't recall her name, but she just gave this. And I think she hit it on the head. I mean, you have to think a little bit. You know, how is it that saving helps marriages? Well, it does. And of course, the psychologist, you know, the counselors, whatever, they do these surveys and they say, yeah, what causes stress in a marriage? Money issues are near the top. So if both spouses learn to save effectively, I think that would help. So it's a strange thing to say that I'm arguing the reason to save is to help your marriage, but I believe it. It's one of the new luxuries, is a marriage that lasts. Because the consumerism treadmill is insane. As I say, I don't want to say there's nothing good in it. If there were nothing good in it, we wouldn't be drawn to it. But it's unbalanced. And what you need to bring balance into your money life is to have it be not just about spending, but to be about spending and saving. So it could save your marriage. And it can save all kinds of things, as I say. I mean, it can help your spiritual growth. It can help you learn, you know. I mean, I'd like to read a lot of the great books before I die. And you can't wait until you're 80 to do it. You know, you might not be able to read then. I mean, your eyes might go. You know, you got to start. Spend time with your kids is a new luxury. You know, spending time on a hobby. That can be a new luxury. The point here is saving buys you something. Saving is not something you do out of self-denial. Do it for a positive reason. Do it to enlarge a part of you, to be a new and better you, or to be the you, you know, to get the you that's inside out. I record this podcast as a new luxury. I couldn't be doing this if I hadn't learned how to save effectively back in the 1990s, and you can do something similar. Stop thinking of saving as self-denial. Stop thinking of saving as boring. Stop following rules of thumb that say everybody should save 10%, like you're a little cookie, you know, being fit for the cookie cutter. Save for what matters for you. And save for the luxuries that it can buy you in this modern world. And the biggest luxury in this modern world is free time. And that comes from buying your time back. That's what it's about. It's a different kind of luxury, you know, than the fancy car or the European vacation. But for a lot of us, it's a luxury that brings more life fulfillment. So it's worth pursuing. Take care.